website?
No, no.
Oh, they got some more stuff on there about the, they had some neat, you got to keep going there.
All right, let's get it going here.
Okay, I guess we're ready to get started.
Yeah.
We don't know.
We'll see. Beautiful. Perfect. Okay, so originally it was supposed to be, how do we measure the size, age, and composition of the universe? That's too big of a topic. When I got into distances, that alone is, you know, that's enough.
More programs coming.
Yeah, maybe. You know, give me a while. Only got so much time. But measuring the universe, specifically, how do astronomers determine distances? I've had, you know, in the Internet astronomy courses I teach, students are always saying, well, you don't know, you haven't been there, there's no way you can know how far away these things are. They just throw these out. Well, actually, there's rigorous scientific measurement going on, and we'll move right along to the first slide, hopefully. What's going on here? There we go. The first shortest, we're going to start with short distances and work our way out. Most people are familiar with this if they're involved in astronomy at all, which is just parallax. If we're here at Earth in July and we're looking at a star against the background, we see the red dot on the left side, and then we move over to January and we see it against different stars. You see the January view, the July view, and you measure that angular distance, the little p there, rho, p, whatever it is, that's from the vertical line to the right angle. And the distance in parsecs is just 1 divided by that angular distance. That's very hard to do from Earth because of the atmosphere. You've got gravity pulling on your mirrors. When you get down to sub-milli-arc second parallax, it gets very difficult. It's very hard to do it for, it only works for maybe a couple hundred light years from Earth. This was greatly improved by a satellite launched by the European Space Agency in 1989, Hipparchos. I'm guessing that's how it's pronounced. The mission ended in 1993. It surpassed all objectives. They measured 118,218 stars with 1 milliarc second precision. They measured a couple million more with better than 20 milliarc second precision. They measured many parameters, not just the parallax. They were measuring proper motion, and this ultimately led to a tenfold increase in precision over ground-based parallax. Why? Again, no atmosphere, no gravity tugging on the mirror and the instruments. Greatly reduces the number of variables in your equation. And they actively control the thermal environment of the scope because it's out in space, it's a little bit easier. And of course, it could see the entire celestial sphere. Unlike a telescope located in either hemisphere, it's going to be limited. So there are a lot of advantages to getting out of our atmosphere. And it resulted in several catalogs, the Hipparchos catalog, and then the Tycho and the Tycho 2. Those were the Tycho and Tycho 2. The Tycho came first. It was using those couple million stars that were at lower precision. And then the Tycho 2 just came out in 2000. It had even more, I think maybe 10 million stars by going through the data again. But that really revolutionized what was done with parallax. But it's still, you know, that got you out maybe 500 light years. But this is used in other measurement techniques. Parallax is sort of the basis for some of the other techniques. So it's important that that be precise. That really helps you tighten up your other measurements because that is the basis for some of the other techniques. Advancing to the next slide, the next method, I underline my methods in the title. Spectroscopic parallax is the next one. I'm going to do 9 or 10 of these, depending on how you divide it, of methods that we use to measure distances, astronomers use. The spectroscopic parallax, that works well for main sequence stars. As long as they're main sequence and you can see them, that works well. That's going to limit you basically to the stars in our galaxy that are main sequence. May work for a few if they're extremely bright in other galaxies, but within our galaxy. So that takes you out to 100,000 light years and maybe a couple million if you can pick up a star in another galaxy that's main sequence. with a big scope. And this technique just exploits the link between absolute magnitude and the temperature of main sequence stars. And they have a three-step approach. Going to the next slide. Yes. Main sequence star. That'll be cleared up by the next diagram. We'll get to that. Yeah, Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is when you plot a main sequence star as one that's in the middle of its normal lifetime. It's not gone out to the red giant stage. It hasn't blown apart to the white dwarf stage. It's just living its happy, normal life. But we'll get to that in the next chart. The first step is you want to determine the wavelength the star is brightest. In other words, the color of the star. This particular star in our example has its maximum intensity. Notice they plot the relative intensity on the left side and the wavelength on the bottom. So the peak turned out to be 420 nanometer wavelength, which if you consider red is 700, 200 is violet, it's, I don't know, somewhere in the green range, who knows. We need the number, 420 nanometers. We need the wavelength where it's brightest. That's the first thing we need. So we got that. We can get that from a spectrum by using a spectroscope, and we can figure out by using a little CCD photometer, we can count the photons at a certain wavelength and figure out where it's getting the most photons at a certain wavelength. And that can be done exactly using modern instruments. Okay. So then we use Wien's law to convert wavelength to temperature. There's just a simple relationship. Wavelength times temperature is that big number, 2,898,000, as long as wavelength is in nanometers and temperature is in degrees Kelvin. 0 degrees Kelvin would be absolute zero. Kelvin's just like Celsius, except it starts at absolute zero and goes up. So for our star, the temperature is 2,898,000 divided by 420 equals 6,900 degrees Kelvin. So when you know the color of the star to the wavelength, you know the temperature of the photosphere, the surface of the sun. The upper atmosphere where the flares are would be much hotter, but this would be the temperature of the photosphere, the actual surface of the star. And we need that because we're now going to use our Hertzsprung-Russell diagram to figure out the absolute magnitude. This little line here, okay, not working. Okay, there it is. This little guy, see my little red dot? This would be the main sequence stars, okay? Those are stars living the normal life. Up here, we've got some stars that have deviated. Well, I've lost my point, but these are not main sequence. These are not main sequence. This is your main sequence line. Healthy, happy stars. The sun's in the middle of its main sequence. It's still on that line. This is a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. Some of you may have not seen it. On the bottom, we plot temperature of the surface of the star in question. And on the left, we have the extremely handy absolute magnitude. That's how bright the star would appear at some standard distance. That's its intrinsic luminosity. You know, if something's really far from you, it might appear really faint. If it's really close, it might appear really bright. You might think the sun's a really bright star because it's so close to us. It turns out it only has an absolute magnitude of almost 5, 4.8. Whereas a type 1 supernova, Type 1a supernova is about negative 19 or negative 29. We'll find out later. So the sun's not really that bright. It just looks bright because it's close to us. But once you know the absolute magnitude and the apparent magnitude, then you can get the distance. That's what the first several of these methods, we seek the apparent magnitude and the absolute magnitude. Once you have both of those, there's a simple relation to let you figure out the distance to the object. So by getting the wavelength of the star's most intense wavelength, we got its temperature using Wien's law. Once we get its temperature, 6,900, I believe it was, we can then go up and extrapolate left to the vertical axis and get a magnitude of 2.5, an absolute magnitude of 2.5 for that star of 6,900 Kelvin. We're there now. Now we have absolute magnitude. Step three is, now we've got the apparent magnitude which we measure. How do we measure apparent magnitude? Well, we could look up and say, that looks fainter than Sirius. We could estimate it to be magnitude 2 or 1. But really, you'd want to use a CCD imager with some photometric ability to count photons. And you can actually count photons and figure out the actual apparent magnitude quantitatively, you know, numerically. So that's an exact measurement within the tolerance of the instruments. So, and then you can calculate the absolute magnitude simply by, again, counting the photons of the best color, the strongest color. And then I've put in bold here, I didn't bother us with letters, but this would be the apparent magnitude of the star, and this would be the absolute magnitude. These numbers don't change. So this is a density. This is the magnitude distance relation. We're going to be referring to this constantly. But once you get the apparent magnitude and the absolute magnitude, you have the distance. This distance is in parsecs. And I wrote here one parsec is that many light years. And then I just did the conversion. And those answers are good to two significant figures only. If you did the math, you'd get something like 2011. But I can't say 2011 because that indicates that I've got 4 significant digits. But because I only measured the apparent magnitude to 2 digits, 14, and the absolute magnitude to 2 digits, 2.5, I can't give you 4 digits that matter. I can only give you 2 digits that matter, so I rounded it to 2 significant digits. 6,500 light years, clearly much further than parallax method could give you. So you're limited by how precisely you can measure apparent and absolute magnitude. Clearly, with the advance of technology, quantum theory helping us out, giving us our CCD imagers, now we can greatly increase the precision of this method because we can get apparent and absolute magnitude very precisely measured to far more digits than I used here. So this is a very good method for determining the distance of main sequence stars. Okay, the next approach, many of you have probably heard of our friends the Cepheid variables. There was a lady who figured this out in the first century of the 1900s. I can't remember her name. But she noticed that these stars were variable. And the longer period, the brighter the star. And they're extremely bright, which makes them very useful because they can be seen, even though they're individual stars, they can be seen in other galaxies, millions of light years away. And we know that the longer the period of variability, the brighter the star. So that immediately puts you in touch with the absolute magnitude. There are type 1, type 2 Cepheids and RR Lyrae. The RR Lyraes, they're found in globular clusters, but they all have a direct period luminosity tie. And luminosity is directly related to absolute magnitude. As soon as you know luminosity, you know absolute magnitude. So the beauty is that you can determine the absolute magnitude from the period of the star. And you can measure its peaks. You can plot it and you can figure out the period in days or hours or seconds. And then you can get the absolute magnitude. Because you can see them far away, it's easy to get the apparent magnitude. And because you can measure the period of variability, it's very easy to calculate the absolute magnitude. Pardon the lifted graphics. They're a little blurry, but here we have RR Lyrae on the left. They're about, the units there of luminosity, those are in solar luminosity, so the RR Lyrae are about 10 times as luminous as the sun. If you get a Cepheid variable with about 2 to 3 day period, means it's variable over 2 to 3 days, it hits a peak and it comes back to a peak in 2 to 3 days, that's about 1,000 solar luminosities. And if you get out to about a 20-day period, you're up to 10,000 solar luminosity. So these are extremely bright, and they make wonderful candles, standard candles. Here's your period showing. It shows you how it varies. That's the apparent magnitude on the left of the bottom photo. So you can see it's varying in brightness very regularly as time goes on. And you can see, well, if you go from here to here, that's 6/10 of a day, 7/10 of a day. You can get your ruler out and get it really precise, but you can get the period exactly. And once you get the period, you go back up to that top chart and you figure out the luminosity. And there's a relation that says, okay, this is the luminosity, this is the absolute magnitude. And of course, once you have absolute magnitude and apparent magnitude, by the earlier relation, you have the distance. So that's another method. Here's one I'd never heard of. The planetary nebula luminosity function. And, you know, don't worry about the little equation. There won't be a test. But in that equation, we have the absolute magnitude, and we have some cutoff magnitudes. That's all fine and dandy. Here's what's important, that first paragraph. It is found that the statistical distribution of planetary nebula brightness in a galaxy obeys the so-called planetary nebulosity function. What is that? Well, it looks like this. If you can find a galaxy where it's got planetary nebulae that obey this function, then you can use them. You can use that to get one, well, the cutoff magnitude, what is this cutoff magnitude, this M star? That's a magnitude after which there are no planetary nebulas brighter than that. And it's found that there are no planetary nebulas with brighter absolute magnitude than -4.48. That's just found throughout the universe. So we know the absolute magnitude at the cutoff. What we don't know is the apparent magnitude. Remember, we need absolute and apparent to get our distance. And of course, with this plot, by the way, the line is the theoretical expectation. The data points, they have error bars, and that's real-world data. But you see the bottom axis is apparent magnitude. So you can use that cutoff to get the apparent magnitude. And once you've got, you've already got the cutoff magnitude, -4.48, now you've got the apparent magnitude, put those together, and that's going to give you the distance to that galaxy. Here's another fun one, the Tully-Fisher relation. This deals with, it's mainly used with gas clouds orbiting the cores of galaxies. You could do it with a star, but it basically says, okay, we have the centripetal force working on a gas going around a galaxy, mv squared over r, mass of the gas cloud, velocity of the gas cloud, divided by the distance from the core. That's got to be balanced by the gravitational attraction, gmm over r squared. Again, that's Newton's gravity. It's an approximation of relativity, but it's good enough for this purpose. And you do a bunch of math, and you wind up with an expression. Oh, by the way, we can measure. It turns out that the luminosity is proportional to the velocity to the fourth power. That's great, because we can measure the velocity of the glass gas cloud by the width of the 21-centimeter line emitted by the hydrogen cloud. So it's something we can measure. And so we've got m is approximately equal to 10 times the log of that velocity. We can measure the velocity directly from a telescope. That gives us the absolute magnitude. And now, again, you use the apparent, you can then calculate the distance because you have the apparent. Let's see. All you need at this point is the apparent magnitude of the galaxy, and then you're ready to go. Here is a plot of what you might see. The log of rotation velocity of the cloud versus the absolute magnitude. And each data point corresponds to a galaxy within a cluster of galaxies. The solid line represents the theoretical best fit. So, you know, it's a pretty good proportional relationship, clearly. Here's another fun one. And all the, you know, some of these others built on earlier methods. Clearly the main sequence, that stellar, let's just roll back to the beginning. Spectroscopic parallax. One key thing about this HR diagram, these are nearby stars. So we plotted nearby stars. Those are ones that we could measure the exact distance using parallax. And because we can measure the exact distance using parallax, we're able to exactly know, we know the apparent and we know the distance. Well, if you know apparent magnitude and distance, you can calculate the absolute magnitude. So we know these guys' absolute magnitude because we knew their distance from parallax and we knew their apparent magnitude from our little photometers. So we use the nearby data to plot the main sequence, and then we know we've got a main sequence star here by looking at its spectrum, and we can calculate the absolute magnitude. But that does build on the parallax method. If there's some flaw we missed in the parallax method, maybe this method's off. So scientists are always seeking for independent ways to measure things. So we'll go back to this approach, the very long baseline interferometry. That comes from the word interfere. It uses the interference of wavefronts. Over the last decade, astronomers have been developing new techniques that will allow them to skip the distance ladder altogether. One of them is VLBI. And they use the very long baseline array. Many of you have heard of this. It's a set of 10 radio telescopes situated around the world from Hawaii to the Virgin Islands. And this allows them to make direct, almost direct, so you've got to do some calculations, but direct distance measurements to spiral galaxies without using any other parallax methods or Hertzsprung-Russell diagrams or any of that. The radio telescope, acting as one giant dish thousands of miles wide, because they stretch across the globe, they were able to tightly focus on the galaxy's core and measure the velocity of water masers. It's like a laser, but it's a little different. Compact molecular clouds that emit an intense radio signal swirling in a disk of gas at the galaxy's center. Combining the maser's intrinsic speed, inferred from the Doppler shift of the maser emission, with the apparent angular motion as seen from Earth, yields the distance d via the formula d is equal to v divided by d theta dt, where v is the intrinsic velocity of the water molecular cloud measured from the Doppler shift of the maser emission, and d theta dt is a proper motion of the molecular cloud observed directly by the VLBI. Sometimes a proper motion of a jet coming out of a cloud is observed. So they basically directly measure this just by studying the motion of these water clouds within the cores of galaxies. There's no other, this is not building on parallax or using any other theories. This is just direct calculations. Here's my favorite, the Type 1a supernovae. These guys are great. White dwarf in a binary system explodes. We'll cut to the picture and come back. Bad pictures, but that's what I lifted. We have a white dwarf. It's sucking matter off of a red giant. We have an accretion disk. The matter is slowly falling in. As enough matter builds up, it eventually reaches a critical density, a precise mass limit. When it reaches that certain mass limit, the atoms collapse, they can't hold up, the electromagnetic force is overwhelmed by gravity, the star collapses, and then it rebounds in a huge fusion explosion, which is, briefly, the star will outshine an entire galaxy. It's one of the most violent explosions known in the universe, and they're always of the same, this is what's killer, resulting explosions always release roughly the same amount of energy and achieve roughly the same intrinsic brightness peak, because it's, again, that critical mass limit. You've got X amount of matter and it does fusion, there's only so much energy you can get out of it. So the beauty is, as they have pinned these down, the magnitude of all type 1a supernovae, -19.33 plus or minus 0.25. That's incredible precision. And these things are so bright, you can see them to the edge of the universe, practically. The trick is catching one at the right time. But if you find one, you can calculate that distance easily, because you'll know its apparent magnitude, you know its absolute magnitude, you'll know its distance right away. And I just put there that the sun is 4.8, so it's a lot dimmer than a type 1a supernova. Oh, and the picture on the left, this is NGC 4526, the star at the lower left. This occurred in 1994, a massive supernova. That lower left bright star was the supernova 1994. Okay, another one is the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. Clusters of galaxies, they have intergalactic gas between them, which is very hot, and it emits X-rays as a result. It turns out the X-ray luminosity is proportional to the density of the gas squared, multiplied by the size of the cluster. They've looked at many clusters and they've figured this out. It's a nice handy little relation. Turns out also that Compton scattering transfers energy between the gas and the cosmic microwave background radiation, CMBR, casting a shadow on the CMBR. Okay, let's look at the picture. So this is the effect on the cosmic microwave background radiation. The solid line is the original cosmic microwave background radiation. The dash line is the effect of the scattering of the X-rays interacting with those photons and the background radiation. So at the lower frequency, it has one effect. At higher frequencies, it has another effect. But they use that. It's dimmer. The cosmic microwave background radiation is dimmer when viewed at low frequencies and brighter when viewed at high frequencies. So what do we get from this? The X-ray luminosity and microwave variation are combined to obtain a direct measurement of the size S of the region containing the hot gas. You can crunch all the numbers from that chart and you will get the size S of the region in that supercluster of galaxies that is creating that hot containing that hot gas. Also, direct observation of that area, radio telescopes, other types of telescopes, will give you the angular size theta, how big in the sky that cloud is. The moon's a half degree in angular size, just for comparison. You'll get the angular size through direct observation. So then you can calculate the distance. D is just S divided by theta. That's just basic good old trig. Arc length divided by angle. So that's another approach to get distances. Here's everybody's favorite, gravitationally lensed quasars. And there are many things that can lens a quasar or distant object, clusters of galaxies, a galaxy. The sun can lens a star. That was what, you know, the first proof of relativity when we saw the sun's a distant star's light been around the sun. There's some debate whether that was within the experimental precision or not, but when a galaxy lies very close to the line of sight of a more distant quasar, the light is deflected, resulting in many images of the same quasar. That's not quite as clear as mine. In my view, you can actually see the galaxy more. I don't know. You can barely see it. But this is clearly the quasar split into four images. You might say, well, that's just four quasars. No, we can look at the spectrum and see they're chemically identical. So we know it's just one quasar, but it's been lensed into four images. And of course, scientists are going to figure out a way to use that to figure out the distance. Quasars are intrinsically bright and variable, lucky for us. And as we know now, they're just very energetic black holes in the center of very massive galaxies. They're sucking in matter into their little accretion disks, and they're emitting a great amount of energy as stuff falls in. You know, black holes aren't really all black, right? I mean, some of them are quasars. Monitoring the luminosity variations of all images allows us to measure time delay between images, which is caused by splitting light into slightly different paths around the lens galaxy. In this example, they had image A and image B, and you had two different curves of days versus intensity. And they're going to use that data. So how do you use that data to calculate distance? I'm not going to give you the math for that today. I'm sure it's very complex. But there are four things that scientists need to be able to calculate the distance using these split quasars. One, we need the time delay, which means the intensity of the background source must vary sharply by large amounts. Quasars fit the bill. Angular separation of the images of the background source. We need to know how far those quasars are apart. How much the light's being deflected. Relative distance of the lens and background source, how far they are from each other. And we can use redshift to figure that out, how quickly one is receding versus how quickly the other one's receding. We can figure out how far they are from each other. Then the mass of the lens, how much that galaxy weighs, if we could put it on a scale, how much matter's in that galaxy, and its distribution. Is it a point source? Is it a uniform sphere? Is it a pancake? What's its distribution? So obviously this is not an extremely precise method. You're going to be doing some computer modeling here, and you're going to be using other methods. But if you have those four pieces of information, you can get a very good estimate for the distance to the quasar. I wish this were clearer. This sort of shows the overlap of the methods. This graph does not show my stellar parallax. My spectroscopic parallax is not in here. That would fit within our galaxy, so that would cover this same region, but only for main sequence. Parallax gets you out to roughly here. It's a little better now than that. Cepheids carry you out about that far. Apparently we can't see Cepheids beyond 10 to the 7th light years. And then these other methods, they work well from 10 to the 6th light years out to 10 billion light years or more and beyond. So the beauty is that they overlap and you can compare one with another. So you're not just relying on one method that may be flawed or may have some extreme experimental error. You can sort of match them together. You know, there's always uncertainty. The Hubble value, I think they've settled on for the Hubble constant is 70 plus or minus 5. So we always put error bars. You know, we're never saying it's exactly 70, but you know, there's always error bars in an experiment. But the point is that we're not just relying on one yardstick. We have multiple yardsticks, and we could test them against each other. The conclusion, many very different approaches to measuring distances coupled with rapid technological advances result in very reliable, precise distances, relatively precise. I mean, not to the inch. We're talking about billions of light years. But, you know, we get an idea of the scale, you know, without actually going there and checking our odometer. Any questions? Yes, sir. It can be, and it really depends on the geometry. That brings in general relativity equations and tensors, which are graduate level math, and it depends on the geometry and the amount of the intervening space, and you do get rings. It's only a special kind. A little galaxy intervenes will get you the four dots or the two dots or three dots, maybe six dots, but to calculate, to use this distance method, you need some distinct dots, at least two. If you get the ring, it's not going to work. And you can get that ring depending, if it's like a supercluster intervening, you're going to get rings and all kind of weird shapes. It will bend the light in any way. You can, unlike with a piece of glass, the equations of relativity, general relativity, allow you to distort space in some very funny ways. So you can make any kind of distribution you want to based on the matter. So, good question, though. Any others? Yes, sir.
I'm surprised why you didn't have the redshift here. Once you calibrated the Hubble constant.
Right, that is one. That is a key one. You know, I thought if I do this again, I'd go into age, and that sort of plays into age, too. We talked about that in my last talk. You know, there's only so much I can cover. That's not a... There's problems with Hubble with that as a distance measurement. It is used, and redshift is used. Yeah, and redshift is, you know, is subject to the expansion of the universe. Hubble thought it was constant, meaning he thought the expansion rate was always constant. We have pretty conclusive evidence that the expansion rate is not constant, and it's not reliable on very large redshift z. So that's complicated too. It is reliable on intermediate distances, but once you get out to bigger distances, there's that question of the variability of the inflation of the universe. So that should have probably been in here too, because that is how distances are talked about. When you say redshift of 8, you know, that's huge, that's far away. But it's not the most reliable yardstick because you don't know reliably how constant the expansion rate's been of the universe. It is dependent on that. But it is an important part of history, and if I ever do one on age and composition, I'll definitely bring it in. But we did talk about that in the last show, so sorry if you missed that. Good question, though. Good. That redshift certainly important. That was, you know, when Hubble found that those galaxies were receding, we realized it was a big place. Until then, we thought we were all in one galaxy. When he saw those little nebulae were actually millions of light years away, he had the distances wrong. They had to recalibrate some stuff, but he realized they weren't in our galaxy. That was the big deal, certainly. What else? Yes, sir. Depends on the Cepheid. Let's go back to the chart.
Polaris, isn't that 11-year cycle?
That's not a Cepheid variable, is it? I don't think Polaris is a Cepheid. It's variable, but it's not a Cepheid variable. See, Cepheids have a special key relationship with luminosity. As their period increases, their brightness increases. The Cepheids 1 and 2 and the RR Lyrae's are the only three types of variable stars that have that relationship of increased period equals proportionately increased brightness. Other variables could be variable because they've got an eclipsing binary, whatever. Inside the star, it's doing funny things. But Cepheid variables, and I didn't do my homework on what causes a Cepheid variable. I don't know if it's something raining matter down on it, like this type 1A supernovae, but there's something very regular and predictable that makes them always behave exactly that way. But I don't think Polaris is one. Anybody know? I don't think it's one. Yes, sir.
I've seen on the web the globular clusters over a imaging session. If you do an animation of them, you can see the RR Lyra variable stars pulsing.
Pulsing. Wow.
At different rates.
Interesting. Yep.
I've seen a couple of web shots of that.
That's cool. Yeah, there's not a lot of increase there. That looks like they'd be tough to use. That's a pretty flat curve there for the RR Lyra. You see.
Well, I've got a period of a half a day. It turns out they're all. I mean, it doesn't. They don't really have that increasing relationship. They all have a set luminosity. The RR Lyrae's are all the same brightness.
So period really doesn't matter for an RR Lyrae. If you find an RR Lyrae, you know its luminosity and you know its absolute magnitude. But I guess you need to know the period to identify it as an RR Lyrae. I don't know. But yeah, that's handy. We were lucky we had those. We would have never been able to find. Well, I mean, we had other approaches, but for a while, it would have taken us longer. It was the Cepheids that first brought the Hubble expansion. That's why we figured it out in 1910. If we had had to wait for these radio maser measurements, it would have been 100 years later, maybe much longer, before we figured all this out. So there is some luck. Yes, sir.
I'm still confused by base. Mm-hmm. If I had a ruler in my fan, and it still look the same distance?
Yes, it would, but...
So what does distance really mean?
Well, in this case, distance is always measured by light. And light, you know, even though space is expanding, light still travels at the same speed. And so what is distance? Distance is just the time it takes light to go a certain distance. Distance is just the speed of light, let's say meters per second. It's just the speed of light multiplied by the time it takes for that light to travel. And that gives you a distance in meters, because they've defined the meter in terms of the speed of light. So speed of light, unlike all other velocities, does not add. It's not additive. You know, if you're riding in a car and you throw a baseball forward, you're going to see the baseball moving. Say you threw it at 50 miles per hour. You're going to see the baseball leave you at 50 miles per hour. But some guy on the ground is going to see that baseball. If the car is going 50 miles per hour, the guy on the ground is going to see the baseball going forward at 100 miles per hour. Baseball's velocity adds to the car's velocity. However, if you have a flashlight, that doesn't work. Both of you are going to agree that the speed of those photons is c if you're in a vacuum. If you're in air, it's a little lower, and if you're in water, it's a lot lower. The more dense the medium, the slower light goes. But in a vacuum, light always goes at speed c. When you solve Maxwell's equations, you just get out that constant. It's not a variable velocity. Right. Exactly. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate that. While we were settling the Civil War, Maxwell was writing those handy equations. So that is the ultimate arbiter. How far something is how many light years away it is. And though space is expanding, yeah, that means it's more light years away. Originally, we were all in, you know, something the size of your fist. I mean, the whole universe, if you run the clock backwards, you know, quantum theory says, no, you probably couldn't compress it down to an infinite point. Points aren't allowed. You don't have infinities in the real world. You know, classically, you can collapse the universe forever. But in the real world, it could not have been infinitely small. You just never see infinities in the real world. So, okay, let's say it was all collapsed down to something the size of Earth. Okay, and then space expanded rapidly through inflation. We're no longer all together. And through E equals mc squared, all that energy of expansion was converted to matter, and we flew apart. We're still flying apart. In fact, you know, the universe is 13.75 billion years old or whatever it is, 7.375, but it's expanded faster than the speed of light during inflation, so they say it's probably 50 billion light years across. And I didn't get into measuring the size of the universe. That involves theoretical stuff and theoretical predictions, but it expanded faster than the speed of light, at least in its early period. I don't think it still is. You know, it was some expansion faster than the speed of light, so there are parts of the universe, our light bubble is growing with time. So as time goes on, we can see more of the universe, but because it expanded faster than the speed of light, I don't think we'll ever be able to see all of it. Yeah?
Is As time goes by, distances get further.
Right. Space is made. It's not like galaxies are flying apart from each other. We're all rising in a batter, a cake dough. The space is the bread. The galaxies are the raisins. Okay, you got a raisin cake. As the cake rises, the raisins are carried further apart. There's more space being made.
More or less the 80% of the stuff we can't see is changing the yardstick.
Right, exactly. Well, that dark energy, which they're finding to be exactly Einstein's constant that he's so embarrassed he put in there, it's actually really there. And it is being measured as one, which is exactly what it should have been. And that, you know, may lead to a big rip where eventually, as you worry about, atoms may rip apart. You know, if the expansion continues to accelerate, yeah, it may eventually rip apart. Absolutely. Down to molecules being ripped apart in atoms. So we hope it slows down, but I don't think we have to worry about it. Anything else? Okay, we're going to wrap it up. Thank y'all.
Something we talked about brought up earlier. How many people here are on Facebook? You know that Midlands Astronomy Club has a Facebook page.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Some you do, some you don't.
I got the link from Elizabeth.
Okay. If you can get your friends with me or Joe or Elizabeth or Pat, or I'm sure you can find a link, or I'll put one out tonight. So we do and there are from time to time things that we post or get posted. I've got all my neat stuff up there. I also took a neat trip last week. I had to be in Northern Virginia for an extra time until I went to the National Air and Space Museum, both downtown and one at Dulles. I'm not going to run through the pictures now. If you want to see them sometime, I'd be glad to, but they're up on my Facebook page. If you've never been out there, especially the one out at Dulles, and you like aircraft, I strongly recommend you go because that place is Wonderland. They've got an SR-71 Blackbird sitting there, and you don't get to see those everywhere. Anybody get? I know this. You want to talk about observing this weekend?
Well, we got. We got stuff moving in on Saturday. I'm not sure how good it's. The Saturday looks like Friday's going to be a better night. Maybe we end up going out both on Friday night instead of. I think. Need to really consider Friday as a primary session night, and then see how Saturday goes along. So,
Chris.
Anybody?
Chris. Yours? Okay. Thank you.
Yes, someone was recording.
Okay. We're being recorded. Oh my God. As we get into these summer nights, a good night in the hand is if you got a chance to go, you better go, because. You're getting to June, July, and August, and it may look good at 4 o'clock, and by 7 o'clock it's awfully dark, and there's stuff whipping around the sky. So if you get a chance to go out, go out. Saturn's in a really good place right now. Get out and observe something.
I saw Jupiter when I was letting the dogs in or out before the sun came up.
It was coming. Anybody got anything else? Our beginners program tonight we didn't have because Hap's not here, but I don't think we've got very many beginners here. Yes, sir.
June refreshments. Would anybody like to volunteer for June refreshments? Give me after the meeting.
I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
We'll probably go set the scopes up if anybody wants to look at Saturn while it's pretty in a good condition.
Oh, refreshments this evening are Tom and Donna Awansio. Thank you very, very much. We are adjourned. Go munch.
Okay.